Hello and welcome to episode 209 of Rogue Startups. This episode, I have a really cool interview with Danielle Simpson and Arvid Kahl, the co-founders and couple behind Feedback Panda, which they started and in 2 years grew to 55,000 MRR and sold the business to Kevin McCardle and the team at SureSwift Capital. This is a really cool interview and one that I've been wanting to do for a long time since Arvid and Danielle and I met at MicroConf Europe in Croatia this last fall, because I was really kind of taken with their attendee presentation about really how intentional and disciplined they were about building the business to sell from scratch and having kind of that exit in mind from the very beginning. And a lot of what they did along the way was informed by kind of that vision they have. And ultimately, in just, you know, 2.5 years or so, it came true. And I think this is a really cool story for a lot of us who want to build a business to sell and at least be able to sell it, whether we ultimately do sell it or not, I think is a different story. But being able to sell and having that optionality gives us a lot of confidence and a lot of peace of mind. And then we dig into, in the last part of the interview, what the reality of that looks like, what selling your business looks like. And it's not all sunshines and rainbows. I think that there's a lot of emotion, maybe some guilt and regret that goes into this, but there's also a ton of learning that goes into the building and the selling process. And then afterwards, a lot of us have the ability to kind of take a different perspective on things and look and say, okay, next time I'm going to build a business like this or serve this type of customer in this niche or with these certain characteristics. So this is a really great conversation, I think, with Danielle and Arvid, and certainly is a founding team that I look up to a lot and can't wait to see what they do next. So with that, here's my conversation with Arvid and Danielle, formerly of Feedback Panda.
Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
One of the things about your talk from MicroConf Europe that was so interesting to me is how everything seemed really intentional. Everything you did, and I think it was kind of the premise of your talk, was that you built the business with a lot of thought, well, a lot of like forethought about like, if we do this, then in the future, this thing will happen and that will allow us to whatever kind of be successful. And ultimately led to selling the business to SureSwift. Am I right in thinking that like you guys spent a lot of time thinking and planning ahead of time and not just kind of shooting from the hip like I do?
Well, I definitely was reading a lot on entrepreneurship and building startups in the beginning, like before we even founded the company. And one of the books that I read that really made a big difference in how I approached this and how we finally approached everything in the company, I think, was Built to Sell by John Morlow. Because the idea of building a business that you can sell at any point, even though you don't have to, makes a lot of sense. You build a business that runs without you, that can run without you, or easily runs without much of your work. So it's highly automated. You're replaceable. That's perfect, even if you don't want to sell the business. So from the beginning, we put a lot of thought into every process, how we could automate it away, how we could take this and turn this into something that works for us instead of us working for it. And if you do that often enough in the business, then everything in the business kind of gets you closer to the goal of building a sellable business. Again, don't have to sell it, right? You can still keep growing it. You can keep receiving value, both monetary and growth and reputation, all these kind of things from the business. But it definitely runs much better if you don't have to do as much as if you had to work on it every waking second of your life.
Does it affect your ability to grow quickly, or did it? I guess the answer is no, because you grew really quickly. but in my mind, like the time to build documentation and SOPs and all this kind of stuff just takes away from time doing things in the business. Is that short-sighted of me?
Well, in a way it's true. Obviously, any kind of activity that is not dealing with the day-to-day operations might feel like it's taking time away from what you could be doing. But then again, you're actually taking time, when you think about this, like you're taking time away from the now, sure, but you're enabling your future self to have so much more time for other things, right? So it's pretty much an investment, a non-monetary investment into your own business to just, like, we did this as part of a process as well. Like, whenever we would have a customer talk to us through our customer service channels, and they would ask a question we hadn't answered before, we would come up with the answer and turn the answer into a knowledge base article, which would then be automatically suggested the next time somebody else, like any other customer in the future, would ask that kind of question. So by taking those 2 minutes, we saved ourselves essentially hours of time in the future that we could then spend on actually building our business and continuing to grow it. So I guess no, because if you take a little bit of time every day, I think, and I struggle with this in my personal life, it's like doing the dishes right after cooking, right? Talking a bit about that kind of stuff. I used to not do that, and I still struggle with it, but it's obviously a much smarter strategy to do a little bit every single day than having to do the one bulky thing for hours once a week. And
I'm so happy you've learned that.
that's when you build a business with your partner, you learn a couple things that are transferable to the personal life. So it's just spending a little bit of time on the seemingly mundane turns out to be very, very helpful in the future.
So Danielle, like practically, what were some of the biggest kind of bang for your buck, like biggest ROI things that you did, like Arvid was saying, like on a daily basis, these little things that then compounded into big time or kind of your investment into the business later on?
I think definitely it was every customer service interaction that we had, both on the knowledge base side of things, which Arvid already touched on, you know, turning a conversation that we had more than once. Okay, now that we've had this conversation more than once, it really needs to be a self-serve option where people can find the answers themselves and not need to take our time to have the conversation. But also, I noticed from a marketing side that we could really turn our customers into amplifiers for our business. So that involved creating a really nice story around the foundation of Feedback Panda, making it relatable, having the teachers see themselves in my story and want to share that as a success back into the community. So a lot of our marketing was also something that we kind of made more efficient instead of trying to have this communication strategy where we were always generating our own content. We would take content, you know, we would make those conversations that we had with customers count or show them what was happening in our story and make it something that they could share. They would share on all of their channels and it would scale so much better than if we, you know, shared it just on our own social media pages or on our own blog.
Now, we really tried to avoid like shooting in the dark, right? We didn't want to just test random things and see if they kind of worked within a couple months. We just were not willing to experiment on that kind of scale because we cared that every single thing we did really had an impact in the community and in the tribe that was the teacher community that we were serving. So there wasn't a lot of like random growth hacks that we tried just to see if we could squeeze out another percent or two. We really made sure we had a coherent story and behavior that we were showing towards our customers because we cared about them. If they weren't just a number that we were trying to get up, trying to increase like some percentage here or there, we really wanted to impact their lives. And that was the easiest, I guess, by doing actual like careful deliberation on the content that we would create, on the communication strategy that we had for every single conversation we had, we were making sure that the customer left in a better place. And I think it's not about scale at that point, particularly not if you're trying to build a sustainable, slow growing startup, right? You don't need to squeeze out 10% growth month over month. It's great. And it happened to us, but that doesn't need to happen to get to a sizable customer base. Because I guess that if we had done all these growth hacks, we could have had 20% growth month over month. So yeah, great. But we still build a great company with 10, right? So you can build a great company with 5. Kind of depends on your churn, I guess. But still, you can build a really nice community of your customers but just carefully speaking to them, right? They're not just speaking about them or using them as some sort of number somewhere. You really want to make sure that you interact with them on a relational level, because that's what it is, right? We're in the membership economy. People don't buy a thing and then they walk away. They buy a relationship, or they buy into a relationship with you over a long, long period of time. Sometimes, like, you have lifetime values in 3 digits, 4 digits for customers at this point. It's not just the person that comes to a store, buys a bit of toothpaste for $3, and then they're out again forever. That's not the kind of customer you're looking at. You're looking at people that you consistently build a relationship with. And for that, you have to be conscious of all these little things and care about each customer individually.
Do you think that the kind of like enabling brand evangelists, or whatever you want to call it, that I think you guys did really well is transferable to most markets, and that something most people like listening to this podcast could do?
I definitely think that I think customer interaction is sometimes overlooked as something that doesn't scale, like really listening to your customers and making them feel heard is something that will always generate value to your company. So I think that is something that would transfer to any kind of company where you have value by just talking to your customers. But yeah, I think what we did was really care about our customers. And, you know, that's a great strategy to actually really care about those interactions that you have.
Yeah, I think it's definitely applicable and almost to every market, because I feel like I've noticed that our customers were highly tribal. A tribal community that's not just teachers. Like, there are tribes all over the place. There are tribes in any kind of industry, and you probably wouldn't even imagine them to be there. I was looking in this for an article I've written just a couple weeks ago, and there is a really, really tight community of plumbers and pipe fitters in New Jersey. They have a forum. They have this really like strong bond between people. They're exchanging like tips on how to do plumbing and how to be efficient and how to get people's pets out of their way without scaring away their customers. There's this whole vibrant community that I just randomly found by looking into some industry that I had no idea of how it worked, just trying to see if I could find a vibrant community to see if there was a tribe. And there was one in a place where I did not really expect it, plumbers in a state. So if plumbers in New Jersey and online teachers in, I guess, southern states of the US, if they can have these kind of tribal communities, they are anywhere. They're everywhere, right? You can find them anywhere you want to look. You just need to kind of see where their water cooler is, where they hang out, both on a formal level, like where do their bosses want them to congregate? Is there like a SharePoint or something? Or on the informal level, is there a Facebook group or a Twitter community or an Instagram kind of community around them? There will always be tribes. And any tribe has this kind of strong bond between members. They all follow the same leaders in their tribe. They're all connected, interconnected heavily, and they all share the same goals and they're interested in the same stuff. So you can find this in any community. You just really have to look for it.
Like, on a practical level, how much of the support that you gave your customers was strategic and content style support instead of like technical or like conventional customer support? Like, how much were you saying like, hey, enable for you to be successful, you ought to think about doing this and this and this, not to achieve this thing in the tool, click this button and do that. You know, like I'm saying, like when we think about support or success, a lot of it is consulting almost. Did y'all find the same thing?
I would say the thing about our customers is they were quite similar in their technical ability. So they were kind of pre-filtered customers that they were already working online. So they had relatively, you know, good enough technical skills to find their way through the application. The biggest consulting we needed to do was to get them to the moment of realizing how we can help them. And this was streamlined because everybody had the same problem, and the problem we were solving was very specific. We were very careful about how we built the product, not to overserve, you know, all of the things we could offer an online teacher. What we wanted to do was to solve two problems: help them build relationships with their students. And the second one is to help them write feedback based on text templates. So that was, you know, 50% of our customer service was showing them that that's what we do. And then, of course, there was the, you know, click here and find this button. But we tried to get rid of all of those kind of interactions through, you know, onboarding videos and the self-serve knowledge base.
Yeah, we never really did much in terms of consulting for additional success, right? They were already pretty clear on what their goals were by using our product, which was a scalpel kind of like product, right? We served a very specific niche of people solving an extremely specific problem. So it was not about like building a career as an online teacher. That was not what we were helping them with. We were just helping them with one of the many problems in that market by design, because we didn't want to be the one size fits all that did everything kind of well enough, but we wanted to solve this one problem the best we could. So we never really expanded further. That, I guess, would have been the trajectory of the business, or at least of the company building more products in that space, had we not sold it at some point. But in our company, for what we did, we were so specific that we didn't need to help them with anything outside of the usage level of our application.
I feel like there's more there about this scalpel. I really like that analogy. And I think it's a tough thing. Like, admittedly, with Castos, and this is terrible to admit, I don't know if we'll keep this in, I've looked at our opportunities for growth a lot of times in product. And I think this is a trap that a lot of people fall into, is like, if the thing did this, or if we can charge people $20 extra a month to do that, then, you know, everything will be better. And it never is. And so I think that the ability to keep a tool really simple and solve a very specific problem is really admirable, because then, well, technically it's easier, right? From a support perspective, it's easier because you have less integrations and less all these like edge cases of things working together. But if you didn't, and Arvid, you mentioned like if we wouldn't have sold the business, we would have gone there eventually. What does that decision look like? Of like, you can grow a business to a certain point, right? With the scalpel tool. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure you say like, okay, our total addressable market is X, you know, 50,000 people. We will never get all of them. So when do you say like, we just need to keep working on marketing and like this viral growth engine that you have? Or when do you say we need to add more tools and go more broad market, or change the tools so we can go up market to, you know, more enterprise type customers?
So I would say that no matter how many features or how much we evolved the product, our market was going to stay the same for this online English community. We often did have this conversation, you know, should we add this new feature? When we first started in those very early conversations, I like was shooting way out to, we could go to homeschooling, we could do, we could get into the classrooms. What a nightmare that would have been. So I think in those early days, Arvid really did kind of rein me in and help me focus on, let's focus on building a great product, a great experience, and solve the problem. That was my problem at that point, the problem of the online teacher, very specifically working for these Chinese kid English companies. And then, you know, later on, when we would have a conversation about, you know, what other things do online teachers need, it was never a product that would be a part of Feedback Panda. We thought, okay, this will be a new product. If we build this out, it's going to be a completely different product. The market's the same. Mm-hmm. It's still the same teacher. Maybe it's the, you know, Panda suite for online teaching now, and there's different products, but, you know, Feedback Panda wouldn't change that much. The core offer was the same.
Yeah, I think if I'm honest with myself, this is a trap that marketers fall into, is blaming the developer of saying like, oh, we're marketing, but the, you know, people want this feature, or the product needs to do this to make my job easier. And I'm talking about myself right now, that I definitely say and think that. And sometimes it's true, I think. Sometimes it is true that everybody wants this thing. If you build the thing, then the marketing gets a lot easier. But I think that's probably true less often than especially non-technical people think, because we think we see the whole kind of customer landscape in the marketing view, and that, you know, we're doing our job, and that if the product could you know, support us more, then we would be more successful. And I just don't think it's true as often as we let ourselves believe.
I think we didn't get to our plateau where we really needed to reevaluate what our offer was. If anything, in terms of marketing, like reevaluating what we needed to do was we just needed to get the product in front of more people, make them aware that they had a problem, because all the teachers weren't on the same level. Some people were feeling the pain quite strongly. Maybe they just taught more students, or they were just tired or had another job. Whatever their reason for seeing the problem was, we were fortunate that they felt the problem. But a lot of teachers were happy to just write the feedback on their own, or they didn't care about building this deeper relationship with their students. So from the marketing side, it was more about showing the value that was being created, not only as a time saver, but yeah, showing that relationship that you can have with the students, also just a higher quality of teaching. Those were the kind of different avenues, same product, same offer, but it just a different messaging.
Yeah, we find that really difficult to talk to people at different kind of stages of awareness, if you will. Some people don't know they have the problem. Some people know they have the problem and don't know what to do about it. Some people know that they have a problem and what they want to do and that there's a product. And then there's people that are choosing between company A and company B. And to talk to all of those different four or five steps or phases of a customer buying journey in one site, I find really difficult. And is something we're actively trying to hammer out right now. It's like on this page where people come from this particular point, are we talking to them at the level of awareness that they have? And I think it's easy for us to write one landing page or one homepage because you only consider that one phase of, you know, a customer could be in or a potential customer could be in, but that alienates whatever 80% of the people, maybe, you know, like a lot of people come to your website ready to buy or having no idea what you're doing. And if your marketing message is not varied or generalized to each of those, I think that's where a lot of people fall short, us included. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're looking at it right now.
And that's where we found it very positive to see competition in our space. There was one company doing something similar to what our offer was when we first started, before we developed our product. And then after that, there were kind of like teacher-led solutions, like a smart Google Sheet that would generate templates, or some other tools. And we always thought, great, now the teachers actually know that they have a problem and that there are solutions available and they should look for solutions. And we were confident that ours was the best. So any competition was just further awareness.
I think we were also very... No, I wouldn't say lucky, but it was good for us that we were in a niche that was so well specified, right? It was so well defined that we had online teachers teaching for Chinese kid English companies that were speaking English natively, that were teaching through their browser, that were from the United States or Canada. Like, yeah. We have a couple more of those qualifying filters. So our audience was so highly specific that anybody who was not part of that audience who came to our website, well, they might just as well bounce, right? That we were not looking for the general market. We were looking for a niche market, and we're trying to like construct a message and construct a communication style that would appeal with the highest likeliness to those kind of people that were in our niche already. So we kind of used the imagery, like Feedback Panda is not a panda by mistake, right? We were serving the teacher market of North American teachers teaching for Chinese companies, right? That there's cute stuff when you teach kids, and then there's the Asian component, the panda is an Asian animal. So all this kind of works together, and that the brand, the messaging, all of this was really specifically tailored to communicate what we do, why we do it, and why they should at least check it out to our specific niche audience. It's much easier if you're trying to go to a niche audience than if you go to a much more generalized audience, because then you have the whole prospect awareness scale that you mentioned by Eugene Schwartz, right? The whole thing with completely unaware up to perfectly aware. Yeah, the more people you have that are different, the more you will have these kind of groups, and the more you will have to build some sort of funnel through your content to get them from the spot where they are to where you want them to be. In a niche, it's much easier.
Yeah, and I think it's just, for us, it's scary to write copy or design a page that alienates people. But it's what we should be doing, because we should be saying, you know, kind of putting the stake in the ground. We are this. We are podcast hosting for people on WordPress that are hobbyists but want to be better podcasters. You know, I mean, that gets a little...
I have to say, but I've been looking into so many. I'm currently trying to get to an MVP with no code, and I feel like I waste so much time on landing pages just trying to figure out if it's what I need. I just want to know, is it what I'm looking for? I don't want to spend too much time, you know, learning the product to find out that it's not what I want. I would love if landing pages would be so specific and tell me exactly what I can do when I get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I think early on, it's easy to be really opinionated because you kind of have nothing to lose. And, you know, with the point that y'all were at or that we're at, or you're like, okay, we have hundreds of new trials a month. Changing the homepage copy is a big deal. Even like split testing, it's a big deal. So, but I think it's something that all of us, again, talking about myself, could do better with. So when we met at MicroConf Europe in Croatia, y'all were about to go sit on a beach for a couple weeks, as I remember. Is that right?
Yeah, we went to the middle of the African bush, actually.
Okay.
I really wanted to go somewhere that would kind of put the stress and existential crisis we kind of felt at the end of having the company put everything into perspective. And there's nothing like looking at a leopard that's like hissing at you and you're wondering if it's going to jump into the Jeep with you. That kind of puts things into perspective.
Yeah, it definitely did.
I can imagine. Yeah. How has it been since the sale and kind of getting back into the swing of things?
Well, I've started writing pretty much the moment I stopped working on the product and working on the business. I fell into this void, like most entrepreneurs do when they kind of jump ships, right? Either sell or the business stops working. Doesn't matter if it's a good or a bad outcome. If you can't work on it anymore, something happens, because you've been working on it 24/7. At least your mind has the prior years. And it was the same for me. The moment we handed over everything regarding the business and I didn't have anything to do, I kind of wanted, so what am I going to do with my time? So what's my purpose in life at this point? And I noticed at that point that I had a lot of knowledge that I had accrued running the business with Danielle for those 2 years. And I never really had time to reflect on it. I just did stuff because that's what worked. And I think most entrepreneurs are kind of caught up in this, right? This kind of operational instinct that we have at some point, but we never kind of codify it. We never document as much as we should. We did that for the business because we needed to get all of this information on the page. And in that process, I kind of learned to really reflect on my experiences and distill that into something that is actually actionable. So I started writing, I started a blog, and I started a newsletter, and I started a podcast recently. I'm just kind of trying to create a lot of content of the stuff that I would have loved to learn 3 years ago before we started the business. And I'm just trying to give back to the community that has been so helpful to me with all the blog posts and podcasts and all these things, with my own content, just writing it down as much as I can, writing down my experiences, what worked, what didn't work, which is the more interesting stuff, I guess, and what I learned in both this business and prior businesses. So I've become a writer, I think, for now at least. I released a guide a couple months ago called Zero to Sold, 25,000 word guide that I'm now turning into a book. So I'm even more of a writer, I guess, will be in the future. I just love writing. It's something that for a software engineer, I guess, is not surprising, because we write all day. We just write different kind of prose. But now writing for people, not just for computers, is also quite interesting to me. So that's what I've been doing.
I have to say it's been much different for me. I I really, I think it's been much more emotional for me to have to let go of the company. And I've been oscillating through this kind of mourning the company, or really actually mourning our customers and this community that we built around Feedback Panda. That was very difficult to say goodbye to. And also, even though I'm not a person that really wanted to identify with, oh, I'm CEO and I have a successful company and I don't hang on to that too much, there was a bit of feeling of defeat, like something was taken away from me and now I have to build up something again. So I knew that all of this was kind of brewing inside of me, and I wanted to get really still and, you know, be intentional about what I moved into next. Not to kind of knee jerk into something just to kind of fill the void. So Arvid and I had a great conversation finally when I was ready to deal with everything head on. And I realized that it was really hard work. And now I have to do all of this again. Like mm-hmm. I have to have a company from the start. But actually that was the part I really enjoyed. Like actually that was the most fun part of Feedback Panda, was building the product. And once the product was finished, it wasn't that fun anymore. It was still great and still wonderful company, but the fun part was really getting that idea into a product. So once I realized that, I remembered that, oh yeah, we co-founded a company while we still had Feedback Panda, and it needs to have a product. And so I have been, I touched on it earlier, trying to get to an MVP without code. So it's been another steep learning curve for me, and I love it. It's awesome.
What is the new product, or what is the company you all founded before?
So it's actually a product with a trainer, a physical trainer. She has an accountability kind of habit building product, and she's brilliant, and I love this program. We kind of hopped into the project as people who could build it. And then I thought, hey, I don't need Arvid to build it from scratch. I want to try to build it this time. So, yeah.
Cool. Do you regret selling the company?
It's a tough one. Because the thing is, I don't think nobody ever doesn't regret it a tiny bit. Right. Of course, we don't regret the fact that we sold it for a life-changing amount of money, and we're financially much more secure than before, and that we have accomplished this. Right. The fact that we have sold a company, that is already something that nobody can ever take away from us. So that is amazing. And the opportunities that this has given us, the people we've come to get to talk to, all these kind of things are wonderful. And it would never have happened if we didn't sell the company. So, no, don't regret it. But then again, it was a lot of fun. It was cool. It was our thing, right? We built this from nothing, and we built it into, yeah, we sold it when it was at $55,000 of MRR. So we grew it within 2 years to this quite substantial amount of money, and it paid off Danielle's student loans and all these kind of things. There was a lot of success, and we would have and could have continued the thing, but we didn't. We chose to sell it. And we have to accept that fact. And it's never one or the other, right? It's like we tried to diversify our wealth, because all of it was bundled up in the company, because that was the most important and valuable thing we had, but also the most risky thing at this point, because every single kind of experiment we did in the company could financially result in devastating losses, right? We didn't increase our pricing beyond the one price increase that we did, because we thought, oh, what if they don't like it? What if they cancel? And no business should ever have this kind of risk attached, right? Where you would do an experiment that you might roll back and everything's fine, but you don't do it because you think, what if, whatever. So I think diversification is important. I was also very anxious and stressed at the end, because we never hired people, which is, I guess, my complete fault. Should have hired a customer service agent, should have hired another developer, but I thought, it's fine, I can deal with it. Well, yes, I could, but burnout was peeking through, right? There was a lot of anxiety about not being able to like deal with technical problems fast enough for thousands of customers, being able to be responsive. Should have just hired people, but I was afraid to do it because I never hired anybody before. So that's a learning. And there was a lot of these kind of things that culminated in me being ready to sell the company. Danielle wasn't as ready, I guess she could have continued.
I would say that regret was definitely one of the states that I was oscillating between, with the, you know, kind of depression of and mourning and totally being excited that, you know, now we had this achievement and this amount of money in our bank account. But I think I'm not one that looks back too often. I'm a very forward-looking person. I'm always thinking, okay, what's the next thing? But I will say that looking back does have a lot of value when you have this kind of clarity. We could not have looked at Feedback Panda from in the middle of it with the kind of clarity that we have now that we've sold it, to recognize the mistakes that were not detrimental to the company, but that we can then, you know, learn, take those learnings and apply them to whatever we do next.
Yeah, I completely agree with this. And it shows for myself in my writing, in the clarity of my thinking that leads into all the articles that I write. I tried to write while we were running Feedback Panda still. And I think it took me 2 months to write like a 1,500 word blog post that was not really good, right? Because it was completely filled with all the anxiety that I was actually still having. And it was about anxiety. So that was kind of weird.
It's more like a journal.
Pretty much. But a journal that nobody can get any help from, because you're caught up right in the middle of it. So the moment we sold the company and I had time to reflect, all of a sudden, all these different things appeared that were not just my operational anxiety, but other concepts that were there, other things that we did that I noticed we did, just only we had the time to look back onto it. So I think being able to reflect, having this clean cut makes it much, much easier to reflect. And I think that'll show in any future endeavors that we'll be part of as well. Like having this knowledge, this kind of stepping stone thing, will definitely translate much better than continuing to be in the hamster wheel, right? Because that's why you're tunnel visioned.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, like risk mitigation is a really good reason to sell. I think all of us in these spaces, if you're doing, you know, less than $10 million a year, it's a really risky business. You know, when you get to that point, a lot of things can go wrong and it's still okay. But, you know, certainly where a lot of us who are bootstrapped or whatever, it's super risky still. And so I think that, I mean, especially, you know, shit now, coronavirus and the, you know, the economy potentially tanking, a lot of us should be thinking about what, not necessarily selling, but like what we're doing in our business to de-risk our lives. Because, yeah, for a lot of us, our business is by far our biggest asset. And it's a super volatile one, even if we think we have a lot of control over it, which I don't think we do. Yeah, but I think the other thing that you said that really strikes home, and I see people in our kind of world do this a lot, is kind of go from one thing that's, you know, a scalpel, a single use, super specific tool, to something that might be a little bit broader market or higher price point or something to where the business could be bigger. And you only can run that bigger, potentially more successful business because you had the previous experience and you learned the things you did. I think for me, it's been a bit that way, like, you know, starting out with one relatively simple business, now being in a more complicated business that maybe has some more potential. I see kind of from what you guys are talking about that you're definitely taking your time, but it sounds like you're on that path to, like, if and when you're ready to do something else, it's going to be, you know, something that could be 10 times the size of Feedback Panda.
Yeah, that was one of the things, right? I think we were sharing a thought right now. But initially, we kind of didn't really set goals, which was a big problem because we had no means to see if we had accomplished what we set out to accomplish, because we hadn't set out anything, right? There was no goal. And for myself, I thought that reaching $50,000 in MRR was the biggest thing I could ever do. So once we did that, yeah, we had no further goals, right? And we didn't have step goals either. Like, we didn't know, when I get to 10, when I get to 20, and then we're going to do this. Like, we're going to hire our first employee at like 15,000, because then we can pay them and can pay for the rest of the business. We never had these kind of goals. In retrospect, we reached these things and we did things kind of more instinctively. But had we set out to do these things at certain parts of the business, we could have been much clearer in getting to those stages and then actually, like, intentionally producing these results, right? It just happened because it happened. And then we figured out some things are good or bad, but we could have been much more clear in the intentionality of what we did in the business.
Yeah, I think that comes full circle, right? Back to your very first question about the intention that we had building the business. I think the structure was very intentional. And then once everything was built and set up, we thought, okay, now let's see what happens. And right. So there was a very large portion of what we did was all shooting from the hip. And we were lucky that most of the time we had very good intuition mm-hmm. or thinking on our feet.
And we were quick to change things if they didn't work out either, both in the software itself, like in the product and in the business. Like there, we had a plan. We started out with like a 10-month plan, $10 a month plan and a $5 a month plan. Turned out $5 a month is not a lot for a SaaS business. And the people yeah. who choose to pay $5 when they could pay $10 for a SaaS product, they also have a different perspective on customer service. I think that, yeah, it was one of the more problematic kind of segments of our customer base, which we quickly eradicated, not the people, but the plan. So we kind of got rid of the $5 a month plan very quickly and then increased our plan at some point from $10 to $15 because added value, added dollars to the price. So we were quick to react to things that didn't work. Also marketing, we tried Facebook marketing, like actually paying for ads. That didn't go anywhere. Google AdWords, I think we tried once for like $20.
Quite unnecessary.
Yeah, we didn't really need that. But we just didn't go too deep into things that didn't make sense. Like that we tried, sometimes we tried. We didn't, like I said earlier, we didn't overly experiment too much because we found a couple things from the beginning that worked for us, which was like the people spreading the good news about Feedback Panda by word of mouth in their communities. And then we kind of doubled down on that, enabling more community, building a network effect, generating feature into our product for people to build even more community. Like we noticed that community was the big thing for our community of teachers, the tribe. So we kind of just amplified that as much as we could and kind of ignored anything else.
Yeah, it's kind of the rule of marketing, right? Is like find one thing that works and then just hammer it until it's saturated, and you guys didn't get to that point. It sounds like you were still growing when you sold it. So that's awesome that you found that thing. I think a lot of people go a long time without finding that one thing that's reliable and scalable. So that's cool. Kind of looking a little bit back and then a little bit forward, looking at what you might get into next, you know, aside from writing Arvid or for Danielle with the habit, if y'all decide to start a, you know, start another SaaS business, what are some things like kind of specifically from Feedback Panda that you saw that you didn't like that you would want to try to avoid next time?
One of the biggest things that we noticed with our business was that we were a German company selling to North American people. And there was a lot of trouble with charges on credit cards. And the systems that the payment providers had built to capture or recapture the failed charges, they were not really nice. So these kind of retain products, these kind of, what's the word for it? Like there's a specific name for
Dunning.
Yeah, Dunning system. Thank you. The yeah. Dunning systems, they were not up to scratch. They were great for North Americans selling to North Americans, but not for people from not North America selling to North Americans. And that's a gigantic market because it's essentially the rest of the world. And for digital products, it makes no difference if you're a German company or Belgian or Canadian or North American. You can sell to anybody. So having 5 to 10% of your revenue be caught up in banks kind of blocking charges, that was one of the problems. And that was one of the problems that we tried to automate by using services that existed, didn't work out. So we had to build our own little internal Dunning tool that would reach out to our teachers through intercom whenever a charge was declined, telling them, well, can you please call your bank? And here is what you should say. This is the receiving bank. This is the country it goes through. Just giving them all this kind of information. And I don't know if Dunning tools have caught up to that specific kind of niche problem just yet, but likely not. So that is something that is interesting. However, I probably wouldn't build it because I don't love Dunning, right? I love helping people. I love helping people build things or just be more productive. That is great. But Dunning and this whole payment system stuff is not for me. So not sure if I would do it. I just saw the problem. And I guess that's what you asked. But I probably wouldn't build a business in that field. And the same goes for developer tools. Even though I am one, I probably wouldn't want to build for that market. Because let's be honest, developers don't like to pay for stuff that they're interested in building themselves. It's always one of these gigantic problems in the market, right? Because we love solving problems or we love challenges, which is, I guess, quite unique when it comes to industries that when a thing appears, we want to tackle it instead of just ignoring it, right? So selling things that solve problems for you takes away from your own agency as a developer, super hard to sell to them. So I found a lot of things that I would have loved to have when it comes to like interface components that show if you have downtime or stuff like these kind of more operational things. PDF generation, also not interesting. There's a lot of problems, but I'm not interested in building them. So, which is why I rather write on my experience or write about my experience right now than to jump into the next software project, because I know that there will be something. I've noticed a couple things in writing that I find unbearable. So maybe I'm going to go there. But yeah, there's a lot of small problems that likely aren't critical. And that's the thing, right? You want to build a business around a critical problem. You're not just any problem. And none of the things that I talked about were really critical. Even the Dunning, that was like 5% of our, 5 to 10, depending on which banks they were with, of our customers, that we could still eventually kind of recover by building our own little thing. So if that is the extent to which this is a problem that people can solve it themselves quite quickly, well, then it's not critical. Then you don't need to build a business if people solve it anyway, right? Only the things that people can't really solve as easily as by having a developer spend a day or two on it, these are the things you want to look into. And I have not found any of these, at least not by quickly reflecting on it in Feedback Panda. All of these were just like either nuisances or tedious problems or with some urgency maybe, but not important, right? With the whole the Eisenhower matrix of importance and urgency, none of these problems that I just talked about were both important and urgent. Some were important, some were urgent, and some were neither. And none of these are interesting for building a like a scalpel-like tool for the bootstrap business.
On my side, I keep thinking the thing that made Feedback Panda work so well is also the thing I wouldn't want to bring into the next business. We were so highly dependent on this very price-sensitive, very kind of volatile English teaching market. And we were so dependent on these few companies that were early stage. So I think, yeah, just the fact that we sold to the teachers kind of made us the last ones to know when there was a change in the teaching portal that we had to, you know, change our integration for. So maybe we would think of a more enterprise kind of solution for that, you know, selling seats for all the teachers and selling directly to the English companies. That would be a dream. But that being said, I don't think online teaching is going anywhere. So Feedback Panda would be very easy to pivot into something. Not easy. I very don't want to say anything is easy, but
just go enterprise. It's no big deal.
Definitely not. No. But there are opportunities in the space, and online teaching is very, so hot right now.
Yeah. Twitter has been blowing up over the last couple of days with the whole homeschooling and online teaching, and like universities have been moving all of their classes to online portals. Like this may just be a wave with Corona being around, but still, this is going to leave a lasting impact, right? Because people, for the first time, will understand that this also works. It's just like working from home. Like, people are now forced to work from home, and they probably will need to go back to the offices in a couple weeks or a couple months from now. Let's just hope that this is the case. But they are going to be in the office, sitting in their cubicle, thinking of the five-second commute that they had from their bedroom to the table that during their work from home time, and now they had to drive for an hour through traffic. This is never
going to look at a computer. Yeah.
Right. This is never going to go away. And the homeschooling through online medium, or just like education through online media, is just going to be the exact same thing. People are going to notice how cool this actually is, and how individualistic it can be, and how supportive technology can be for reaching like higher states of understanding in certain concepts. I think this is not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. And I think with all of the decisions that seemed like the only option for Feedback Panda, it's all about weighing the pros and cons. Like, if you look at we sold directly to the teachers. So now we're selling to a lot of teachers who are quite price sensitive. Mm-hmm. But if you look at this compared to selling to a school board, mm-hmm. selling to the individual teacher is a lot more attractive. So it's, I think with all of the decisions that we made in Feedback Panda, it's all about being intentional again. Mm-hmm. It's weighing the pros and cons and then just making a choice and saying, okay, I'm going to live with this downside, the fact that our teachers are price sensitive, but take the pro, which is I can sell to them directly and that's going to be a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they actually have a budget. Unlike schools, teachers that teach for themselves, that teach for different schools, they understand themselves at least a tiny bit. In most cases, a large percentage of them understand themselves to be a business. Like these are teachers that are essentially freelance teachers, right? They teach for one Chinese company, maybe two, maybe three. They have all their different schedules, which is also something that they need help with, right? There's a lot of problems in the online teaching space that are completely unsolved. Scheduling your lessons with multiple schools or tracking your payments through multiple schools, making sure that for the lessons you taught, you actually get paid the right amount. We saw all these problems from the beginning. From day one, we asked people, so what are your other problems? Just to see where the problem space is and to see if there's criticality in other problems as well. Right? We just wanted to see, like, are these important things? Can we help them with important things? Because that's what we want to spend our time on. And we didn't find any more critical problems. They were as critical as our problem was at that point. But who knows? The industry is definitely changing and it's growing. And it's definitely, these things become more important. So there's a lot of space still in the edtech space, in the edtech industry, for bootstrap businesses to go into and solve particular problems. Scalpel method, right?
Awesome. Very fun. Arvind and Danielle, thank you. This is a really, really cool conversation. Thank you for taking the time to share your story and what you've learned in the last few years with everyone. For folks who want to kind of catch up with y'all and kind of connect and learn more, what are the best places?
So I am on Twitter and Instagram under the same handle. It's at SimpsonDannyK. Danny is spelled D-A-N-I.
You can find me on Twitter at ArvidKahl, ArvidKahl, and you can find my blog at thebootstrapfounder.com.
Awesome. Thank you all very much. It was wonderful.
Thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.